David Beckham has a plan, but he needs you to agree with it. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Beckham's group is pitching an idea to lease the land where Miami's Mel Reese Municipal Golf Course is currently located. He wants to build a soccer stadium and a bunch of other stuff. But the city and the voters have to approve a no-bid project to let this go forward. Is that the right thing for the city? Plus, obesity rates in Florida were already some of the highest in the country, but a new report out of the University of Florida and Florida Hospital shows they're actually higher than we believed. Geography, education, and ethnicity play a role. We'll learn more about their findings. And think back to your internship. What did it teach you? We talk about a program in Miami that's getting high schoolers some interesting internships. Oh, and by the way, did I mention they're paid? All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, on Thursday, the Miami City Commission will discuss the possibility of leasing land to the David Beckham Group so that he can build a soccer stadium. This vote has large implications. This will be a big, no-bid project that the city decides to go ahead with a lease. That land is where the municipal golf course is located. Now, over the weekend, one of Beckham's partners, Jorge Mas, released the first renderings of what they are considering to build on that territory. Should the city lease that land? Is this the best place for a soccer stadium? And what about the Overtown project that Beckham was pursuing before? We're joined now by Miami Herald reporter Joey Fletches from the WLRN studios in Doral. Joey, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Lewis.
All right, the Beckham Group is going before the city on Thursday to make their case for this proposal. Will Beckham and Jorge and Jose Mas be in attendance? Do we know?
We know that David Beckham and Jorge Mas will be there Thursday afternoon. They're going to be personally making their pitch to five City of Miami commissioners for this project. And what they're going to be asking for specifically is for the commissioners to approve sending this issue to the voters for a referendum. So they're basically saying allow the basic terms of this deal and this agreement to be put on a ballot item in November so that the voters can have their say on whether this is a good idea or not. And then it would if it would get that far and pass eventually, it would come back to the city commission for more consideration.
And do we get a sense that the city of Miami is, again, they're paying for the stadium and everything else, but this is about leasing this land, losing the golf course, leasing the land so they could build all of this stuff on it, which we'll talk about in a second. But do we get a sense of how people in Miami feel about this right now?
There's a lot of mixed feelings about it. Mel Reese Golf Course is the only city-owned golf course in Miami, the city of Miami, so obviously many other golf courses in Miami-Dade County, but the one next to the airport is Mel Reese, and that belongs to Miami. The First Tee program is a youth golf and mentoring program that is run out of this facility, and a lot of people believe that that should remain intact. There are folks who believe that Mel Reese Golf Course, although not a passive park that you or I could go walk, take a stroll through on any given day, still it constitutes green space in the city that should be left alone. Now, on the other hand, there are soccer fans who believe that this is an excellent way to finally establish a home for a future MLS franchise in Miami, and that this is a good way to and there are some commissioners and folks in the administration who see the dollar signs, who see potential tax windfall when this is developed, because it's not just a soccer stadium. And we're talking about a very large redevelopment of a portion of this site.
Yeah, they came out with this big plan, a lot of stuff that they want to build. I want to mention, too, by the way, that on our Twitter and Facebook page, just look up WLRN Sundial. We're doing a poll right now. And, well, so far, I mean, look, it's unscientific, but so far we've heard from a number of you, and 88% say yes, this is a good idea. So, Joey, what are the Beckham people proposing? Because it's more than a soccer stadium. They're proposing a whole bunch of stuff.
Right. So a 25,000-seat stadium actually is only about 10 acres on that land. We're also talking about a significant amount of restaurant and retail space, an office park, hotel rooms, soccer field and a redeveloped public park. So as opposed to a golf course, it would be like a regular public park on the east side of the site, and also a golf entertainment facility. Some of these details.
Yeah, I let me jump on that one first. So sure. There's a fear of losing the golf course, and yet they're offering a golf entertainment site. What are they pitching?
That's a great question, because we've had these details come out very slowly. Jorge Mas and Jose Mas's brother and David Beckham haven't been very vocal about any of this in the past several months. We know they've been working on a deal, and only in recent weeks have we heard about any of this. And so on Sunday, there was a fact sheet that was released by Mas that included attached to it that rendering that has circulated now, and we published on Sunday. But the golf entertainment facility didn't have any additional information attached to that, and we still have unanswered questions about what that's going to be, how big it's going to be. Is this a Topgolf? Is that supposed to solve the golf issue? I don't know. That's some of the stuff that we're either going to hopefully get, you know, from them in the next couple of days, or just here on Thursday,
or a very fancy putt-putt golf course.
Exactly.
what does the city get out of this? I mean, this would be a no bid project. On a very big chunk of land, but what do we get out of this?
So what the development team is offering, what they're saying is going to be beneficial to the city, is the tax revenue and the park. Apart from the people who want to see a soccer team, an MLS soccer team in Miami, they'll get the stadium and they'll be able to go see the team. The city is being promised a significant amount of tax revenue, an estimated $44 million is what they're saying. And we're just now starting to unpack some of what that means. That $44 million figure was generated by Moss's team. And we're just now starting to break down what individual tax categories that comes from, and therefore try to figure out how much money they expect to make off of this, because the taxes are percentage of what they make, right? So there's some layers to that that we're still unpacking in these a couple of days before the meeting. But essentially, they're saying $44 million in new annual taxes, a $20 million gift to the city of Miami paid over 30 years to redo the park, that swath of just regular park space that would be on the east side of the site. And public soccer fields, which city commissioners have long said that there's a dearth of soccer fields in the city. There would be about 20 acres, if I'm remembering correctly, 20 acres of soccer fields.
So is there enough opposition to this? Are there enough people who believe that the golf course should be protected because it's in demand? Is there a big demand for it?
There is definitely a vocal group of people who feel that there is demand, and there is a demand among folks, by the way, who don't live here. I mean, the golf course is known for hosting tournaments that are not perhaps your top shelf golf tournaments. I don't want to offend anybody who's a golf fan, but so that's maybe not the best term to use, but the ones that you immediately come to mind, even to the average sports consumer. There are still tournaments there, though, and they're prestigious. And the Latin, when I went out there a couple of months ago when this first started to bubble up and discussion started about whether Mel Reese would be a site, I talked to some Latin PGA tour members from South America, and they say that whenever they come through town, they come and practice in Mel Reese. So there is Mel Reese does have a cachet and has a reputation. One of the more vocal members of the opposition to this plan is actually former Miami Mayor Manny Diaz. So there's Ray Allen actually just came out today saying that he likes the first tee program. He believes in it. He thinks it should be left alone. So you're starting to see some big names. To quantify it, be tough to say right now at this point. I think there's going to be a strong showing on both sides at City Hall on Thursday.
We're talking with Joey Fletcher, Miami Herald reporter. We're talking about this proposal that's going to be coming up this week at a Miami City Commission. David Beckham and his group are going to be proposing their idea for a soccer stadium and a whole bunch of other projects that would go on the municipal golf course, the city municipal golf course, which is near the airport. They want to lease that land for decades, and they're promising a lot of tax dollars for the city. But is that a good idea? Now, we do have a poll going on right now on Facebook and Twitter. Just find us at WLRN Sundial. Let us know what you think. If this gets on the ballot, how would you vote? Yes or no? That's what we want to hear from you. There is, I did see Joey And you probably saw it as well. I saw it on Facebook, a couple of places where they are planning a little, well, it looks like a party before the commission meeting. Like, you know, a lot of supporters are going to be out there ready to really show up for David Beckham. But do we get a sense that opposition will also show up in big numbers?
I think so. Yeah, the supporting side of this is going to be galvanized by this, the will and the need for some people to see MLS finally be realized here in Miami again for the second time. But yeah, there's we saw a lot of energy at an event in January at the Arch Center where MLS announced that Miami was going to get a franchise. You can probably expect a very similar amount of energy and sort of spectacle attached to Thursday's hearing. There's basically going to be a tailgate outside City Hall. I can imagine that there will be soccer supporters marching from somewhere to City Hall as a showing of support. On the other side, I think you can also expect a lot of folks who play at Melrese, some notable names, come out and say that they think that this park should be left the way it is.
Before we finish up, I wanted to ask you, because originally they were going to build the stadium in Overtown, and the Beckham Group had some parcels of land, and they were looking to expand on it so they can build their stadium. But what happens to that now?
That's a good question. So the county is in the middle of a litigious situation here with the owners of some of those acres in Overtown, which is the Beckham team. Beckham owns some of that acreage, but the county owns another piece of it, and Beckham has the right to buy it. They have it; they own it under contract. But an adjacent landowner is suing, and so that deal is actually sort of in flux. And the county has recently agreed to allow a deadline to expire, a deadline that was in June, where the Beckham team would have had to make a down payment on that land. They let that expire because of the litigation, from that lawsuit from the adjacent landowner. So all that to say, that deal isn't completely been settled in terms of the sale. At the same time, there is movement because the next door neighbors to this site in Overtown, it's affordable housing site, Culmer Gardens, and that is going to be redeveloped. And the redevelopment of that has been slated for quite some time. So there's talk that perhaps the Moss brothers are going to participate in some way in that redevelopment and offer some of the land or help out.
You wrote about a private party in South Beach, and a number of commissioners were invited to this party prior to the vote that's coming up, prior to the discussion on Thursday. Are there concerns relating Florida Sunshine Law about this party and the commissioners?
There were concerns. Last week, when invitations went out, it was made clear that the invitations were sent to all five commissioners in the city of Miami. And given the fact that they were going to vote to put this on the ballot or not, 24 hours later, I started asking questions about it. I reached out to the Ethics Commission. There were some conversations that happened then between the Ethics Commission and the city, and it ended with the commissioners being advised by their attorney that through the ethics opinion that they probably shouldn't go.
And another thing, too, real quickly, is that there is a C.J. Jimenez, one of the lobbyists for the Beckham Group. This is the son of Miami-Dade Mayor Carlos Jimenez. Is there an issue there? Is the mayor in any way connected to this?
Well, as far as the Overtown site goes, because that is a transaction between the Beckham Group and Miami-Dade County, yeah, there is a question. The mayor's staff, the county mayor's staff, has said that there's no reason for him to be recusing himself at this point. But there is a question of, because on the Miami side of this, C.J. Jimenez has been lobbying Miami commissioners for the Melrese site, whether on the other end, on the Overtown site, the county mayor should step away from this. It's one of those Miami sort of situations. You got a lot of familiar faces, and you got a lot of the same faces appearing, whether they're appearing, you know, on the political side or on the lobbying side. And it makes you wonder, you know, who knows who, and whether this is, you know, something that should be considered a situation where the county or where the mayor recuses himself and steps away.
I did mention the Sundial poll. Again, very unscientific. I just want to hear from our listeners, though. What do they think about this? But what about the Miami Herald? Are you guys polling? Are you trying to figure out what the citizens of the city feel about this issue?
We're not doing polling, but we're trying to cast a wide net and really just do some ground level reporting on how people feel about this. We've also been receiving, unsolicited really, a lot of input from folks. I've gotten a lot of emails in the past several days from and tweets from people who say, I want soccer. This is a great place for soccer. Look at all the good things that are going to happen. I mean, this is a $4 million in rent to the city annually, the $44 million figure in annual taxes. And on the other end, you know, leave Mel Reese alone. Don't pave over a park. We like First Tee. We like the golf course. Go build it in Overtown. Go build it somewhere else. You know, so I'm hearing a little bit of everything. At this point, in the very unscientific, you know, count of emails I have and tweets, it's been probably 50-50, maybe 40-60. It'll end up being the commissioner's decision. Right now we don't know. Thursday's going to be an interesting conversation because we can expect a lot of details we don't already have to be unveiled. And if they're not, we'll be left with a lot of questions when this vote is cast, but you know, we'll see.
Joy Fletches, reporter with the Miami Herald, joining us from the WLRN studios in Doral at the Miami Herald, talking again about this conversation that's coming up with city commissioners, Miami City commissioners on Thursday, as David Beckham is going to present his idea for this new soccer stadium and a whole bunch of other stuff they want to build over where the municipal golf course is. They want to lease that land. And, of course, this will go to the voters eventually. So, you know, what do you as a voter, as a resident of Miami, feel about this idea? We have a poll right now going on Twitter and on Facebook. Just find us, WLRN Sundial. We'd love to hear your thoughts for this. Joey, it's always a pleasure, man. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Still to come, Floridians are struggling with obesity. We talk with researchers from the University of Florida about what they found recently about food culture and how it may lead us to getting fatter. It's all next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, obesity in Florida may be a bigger problem than we originally thought. The University of Florida, partnering with Florida Hospital and the nonprofit Obesity Action Coalition, looked at the health data of 9 million Floridians. They found 37% of adults in the state are obese. That's 10% higher than the number presented by the Centers for Disease Control. The research breaks down obesity rates among different ethnic groups in the state and geographic regions. Dr. Stephen Smith is the co-author of the report and is a researcher and physician focused on the root causes of diabetes and obesity at Florida Hospital. He joins us now via Skype from Orlando. Dr. Smith, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me on this afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here.
Appreciate having you here. Now, why did your numbers show that obesity was higher than we originally thought?
Yeah, so when the federal government determines what the obesity rates are in a state or even at a county level, that data is collected by calling people on the phone and asking them how much they weigh and how tall they are. And we know from other studies that that's not always accurate. So the researcher team went into our extended database and actually took measurements from people who sought healthcare within the state of Florida. And that's where the data comes from. It's actually measured data as opposed to asking somebody how tall and how much they weigh.
Because basically the other thing, too, is that we're not always telling the truth about how much we weigh, right?
Yeah, well, let's just say that not everybody believes the scale when they step on it, and sometimes we're taller and prettier than we think we're going to be. So this is just part of measuring as opposed to asking people what they feel or think. And clearly that was the case. 10% is a big difference, too.
So how does Florida compare to the rest of the country?
Yeah, so Florida, if you look at the federal data, again, but just by asking people, sits kind of in the middle of the stack in terms of obesity rates. A little bit higher in diabetes rates because the population's a tad bit older than the rest of the country. But I think what we showed here is that those numbers really need to be called into doubt because when we measure directly, we see rates that are much, much higher. So I think we got more of a problem than we think as the third largest state in the union now. Don't forget that.
Let's start by defining obesity. We should know what it is, but I mean, clinically, what does it mean to be obese?
Yeah, so we use a definition called the body mass index, and basically we take your weight and divide it by your height squared. It's pretty simple calculation. There are calculators all over the internet you can go and find. And we use a cut point of the number 30 is where we get that cut point from, as qualifying somebody as an adult, not children, but adult, as being being obese. The number that we use for overweight is 27. So it's a pretty simple calculation that people can make. Just measure your height and measure your weight and go to the web and put it in a calculator. It'll give you your number.
So let's break down some of the stuff that you found in this research. Let's look at different groups, ethnicities, and race. What did you discover there? Anything surprising?
Yeah, there were some surprises here. I think first, when we've looked at other data in other parts of the country, we know that African Americans, Hispanics, both have a higher prevalence of obesity than Caucasian populations, and that was confirmed here as well. So the overall rates in those two populations were much higher than they were in the Caucasian populations. And again, some of that was expected. But for example, one finding that I find very intriguing is that Hispanic men tend to have more problems, at least in Florida, with obesity than Hispanic women. And so there are some kind of details in here that are going to be important as we begin to develop strategies to try to help people focus in on what they can do about preventing weight gain in particular.
And do we know why that is? What is it about ethnic groups and race? Why we find more obesity in Black communities and Hispanic communities?
Yeah, so there's been a lot of discussion around this. Some of it has to do with just our ancestry and our genetics. And there's good evidence to say that that has some bearing here. But there are also social and cultural issues, particularly food culture and other socioeconomic factors that come into play as well. And it's really complicated to tease those apart. And suffice it to say that, you know, lower education and lower income also go along with obesity. Poverty is a place where obesity presents itself, and diabetes as well, because obesity in many people will lead to diabetes. I mean, the other part of this, in addition to the food culture, is you know, other activities or other parts of our culture, like our participation in leisure time physical activity, getting out for walks in the evening, you know, things that help burn calories off that we know can help prevent weight gain as well. So it's kind of complicated, but those are kind of the big three. Just to recap, our race and ethnicity contributes, physical activity and that culture goes along with it, and then our food culture comes with us through our families as well.
All right, so we talk about those, and food culture is the one I wanted to start with, because one, I needed you to define for us, what is food culture? Is this just the attitude that we have toward food and how we're raised to think about food?
Yeah, it's not only that's a big part of it. You know, the families, our extended families and our nuclear families and the culture that we grow up in, you know, those food cultures follow us wherever we go in our life. That's incredibly important. I would say also that our neighborhoods and our schools that we go to create a food culture for us as well. And our environment, you know, what foods in the grocery stores that are around us and what kind of festivals we go to. I mean, food culture is, broadly speaking, all of those environmental determinants that contribute to what foods we select and how much we eat of those foods, too. I mean, if you look back 50 years ago, we had smaller plates because we ate less. And now plates are bigger and people are eating more. So it's not just about the food selection. It's about how much food's on the plate and how much people actually consume.
And what about also sometimes we're focused on trying to eat healthy because we have access to healthy foods, and some people may not have that easy access to healthy foods, but they have access to fast foods.
Yeah, that's for sure. And, you know, if you look at many of our fast food chains that are, you know, all around us in our society, it's interesting that some of them have worked really hard to incorporate healthier foods into what they offer, and some of them really haven't. And at the end of the day, You know, it's a two-part equation. It's what's available and what people choose. And for the large part, if people were seeking out healthier foods and buying them, then I'm sure the businesses would follow that as well. So it's a two-way street here. It's not just about what's around you. It's what you choose yourself. And so it's an interesting kind of back and forth on this. And this concept of food deserts, where, you know, neighborhoods don't have grocery stores within walking distance that serve or sell healthy foods, even just fruits and vegetables. I would say that's absolutely true and a contributing factor. But we individually should be in those grocery stores asking them, where are the bananas and where are the vegetables that we want to take home and cook and that sort of thing, too. So it runs both ways.
I'm speaking with Dr. Stephen Smith at Florida Hospital. He's the co-author of a recent study about Florida's struggles with obesity. The study found nearly 2 in 5 Floridians are considered obese. Dr. Smith has researched the root causes of obesity in different communities for years. He joins us via Skype right now from Orlando. What's the correlation, Dr. Smith, between education and obesity?
Yeah, it's actually pretty strong. One of the major determinants of your overall health is the zip code that you live in and progressing, as we know, progressing through the educational system actually reduces the risk for developing obesity and diabetes as well. Part of that, again, is the environment that we live in. Part of it is simply education around, you know, what healthy food choices are, and part of it's being able to afford those healthy food choices. So it's not one thing that leads to economics and, you know, one's own socioeconomic status in the development of obesity. It's probably many, but there's a clear relationship there as well.
The study didn't look into childhood obesity. I know that you have another study coming out soon that's focused just on that. But when it comes to the issue of education, just staying on this for a second, do you think schools are doing enough to inform kids on values and habits of healthy eating and exercise?
Yeah, I look at it this way. I would answer the question, yes, I think there is more we can do here. And the competition for that educational effort is really those environmental things that we're talking about. It's fast food advertising of high calorie meals with high fat content and sugar fizzy beverages, which we see all the time, kids do in particular on TV. And I would say that our educational system, if we're going to improve the health of our communities, needs to work on the educational side just to really get into the why for kids. You know, they need to pay better attention to what the advertising world can do to push foods that we, I think, most generally agree are not healthy in the composition or in the sizes that we serve in our fast food restaurants in particular.
So looking at, you talked about some of the other factors, I wanted to ask about geography. And when we look at the geography of Florida, we find more obesity in the northern part of the state than the southern part of the state. Is that accurate?
Yeah, it certainly is. And, you know, those are predominantly the top half of the state, if you will, is predominantly rural. And the obesity rates on the maps that we created are, you know, probably another 5 to 8% higher in those parts of the you know, the great state of Florida. And it's very clear to us that some of that is actually due to socioeconomic status, but some of it is due to you know, rural food culture and some of the access to healthy foods that we see in rural communities. And we actually need to drill down deeper into the data we already have to really understand this better. But it's clear that the obesity rates in some counties in the northern part of the state are, 40 to 45%. And that's not trivial when almost half of your population has a problem with obesity. The health impacts are huge, cardiovascular disease, development of diabetes. But there's an economic factor here, too. Healthcare costs go up with each BMI point that we talked about. So persons who have obesity are more likely to consume healthcare and spend money on healthcare, particularly for some of these chronic diseases. So it's not just a cosmetic issue here. This is a real economic and healthcare issue for the entire state, but again, particularly in the north.
You partnered with the nonprofit organization Obesity Action Coalition for this research. Why is it important to include an advocacy organization in the development of the study?
Yeah, you know, it's very interesting. That organization is a national organization that really works on behalf of persons with obesity to make sure that they're represented at multiple levels, both politically, economically, within the workplace, but also in the research that's conducted around the condition. And I would say if we were doing a similar study in some other disease like cancer or heart disease, we'd want to have the same kind of, if you will, citizen scientists who are working beside us to help make sure we get the right questions, but also when we come to interpret the data, we bring it back to the persons that we really serve here, in this case, the persons in Florida with obesity.
So what are the challenges of trying to communicate the value of healthy eating and exercise in communities when they have that food culture or way of living that what kind of contradicts? And look, to be specific, you know, and I'm Latino, you know, a lot of fried foods, a lot of tasty, tasty fried foods, not necessarily healthy, but, you know, I mean, it's what I grew up with. So but what are those challenges?
Yeah, I think there's challenges and there's opportunity here. You know, the challenge is the what you just mentioned, and that is we grow up with some of these foods and we understand them. They understand us. We learn to love them. But I will give you an example here from Orlando. We work with a fabulous group that has reinvented really the African-American menus and palates to be able to say, oh, maybe there's a better way we can take those same foods and make them more healthy for us. Or we can begin to educate folks on what it means to have some of that maybe less healthy food, but to make sure that we have colorful plates with other things on there that engage the tradition, not reject it. And I think that's the real key for us, learning to both love our food and our food culture and tradition, but not reject it on the outright. That doesn't seem to be working. And incorporating really healthier ways of participating in that food culture, I think, is really the direction we should go.
You know, we're surrounded by information, books, videos, and everything else that tells us, you know, how to exercise, how to eat healthy. And we've been told from the earliest days, we got to live a healthy lifestyle or we're going to run into these problems later in life. And here we are. We found out that the obesity rate is actually higher than we were told. So what's the answer in trying to reduce obesity rates? I mean, information's out there. It's not like people don't have it.
Yeah, so I think, you know, if you look at the things that actually work, because there's so much out there with nutritional supplements with no data to support them, we spend billions of dollars in the United States on things that don't work. And I think simply focusing in on the things that we know do work, understanding the complexity of how and why it is that people become overweight or develop obesity, which we haven't even touched the surface of that in today's discussion, but for example, we know that people who get 10,000 steps a day are less likely to gain weight over time. And if you just prevented weight gain in this country by having people move a little bit more and begin to, you know, pay more attention to their diet, we could actually level off our obesity rates instead of having them continue to increase. So I would say, you know, it sounds simple to eat less and exercise more, but I'm not saying you have to go to the gym 5 days a week. I'm saying what we can do is get out and have a nice walk in the evening with friends, or get up early if it's going to be a hot day and get a good walk in before the day starts. These kinds of things are really known to help prevent weight gain. And I think when it comes to our food culture, we pretty much know, as you mentioned a few minutes ago, what we shouldn't be eating, okay? And I think just acting on the things that we already know is probably a good start before we get too complicated a message out there.
And I'll finish with this. I mean, it is going back to some of the factors, and socioeconomic being one of them. Is this a class issue?
I think it can be, but I think it also is a cultural and economic issue, as I mentioned earlier. We are bombarded with messages that are not always in line with good health, and we need to recognize that and also do our best to counterbalance that. We do, most of us, I think, intuit, maybe learn in school what our mama told us at home, is that, you know, you need a colorful plate, eat your vegetables, don't eat too much, and stay active. I think it's not a terribly complicated message. But this ability to incorporate healthy foods into our wonderful food culture here in Florida, I think that's another point of intersection where we need to do more work.
Dr. Stephen Smith is from Florida Hospital. He's also the co-author of a recent study about Florida's struggles with obesity. As we mentioned, they found that there is more obesity in the state of Florida than we originally thought. Dr. Smith, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Hey, thanks for having me on this afternoon. Enjoy your show.
All right. And again, he joined us via Skype from Orlando. I know it's lunchtime. Did I just convince you to get a salad instead of a burger? All right. Still to come, an internship program in Miami teaching kids a lot of great skills, especially about personal finance. That's next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, do you remember your first internship? What kind of things did you learn? What would have been your dream internship? Well, this summer, about 2,000 high school students in Miami-Dade County will be taking an internship program in a variety of different ways. They're going to be doing things from banking, information technology, law enforcement, hospitality, a lot of stuff. And by the way, they're getting paid for these internships. The program is funded by the Children's Trust and offers work experience and school credit for these students, and again, placing them in fields related to their goals and their interests. One of the students is Nicholas Mesa, who is joining us now in studio this summer. He's interning at the United States Securities and Exchange Commission. That's wild. Nicholas, welcome to the program, man.
Thank you for having me.
That's awesome. I want to hear more about this. Also joining us is the Director of Public Policy and Community Engagement for the Children's Trust, Donovan Leeson. Donovan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
All right, Nicholas, come on. I got to ask you about this. You're interning at the United States Securities Exchange Commission. That's pretty heavy, man, for a high schooler, too.
Oh, yeah.
First of all, how did you get this?
So my lead teacher, Miss Anna Marable at the Business Academy in Coral Reef Senior High School, she kind of heads this whole internship program. And she called me up one day and she was like, we have this opportunity for you here at the United States Securities and Exchange Commission, and I'd love for you to be a part of it. And it was just luck of the draw, I guess, but she based it upon, attendance, academic records, all that stuff that shows a good student, I guess, that sets you apart. And she chose me. I went through the interview process, background checks, all that good stuff, and I was lucky enough to be actually able to get it.
All right. I mean, look, first of all, tell me the internship. We hear those stories about internships where, you're getting coffee, you're just doing some basic stuff. What kind of stuff are you getting to do?
Oh, it's awesome. I mean, for the past few weeks, I've been able to I'm part of the Business Academy. We've gotten certified in Microsoft software such as Word, Excel, PowerPoint, and I've actually been able to apply that to my actual jobs, working with cases and stuff like that. I've even been able to learn about investigative and court processes more, about subpoenas, the document productions, as well as testimony transcripts. And I've been updating litigation correspondence, pleading case files, preparing trial exhibit logs.
All right, let's go through one as an example. For example, I know there's stuff you can't tell me, but yeah. Tell me about like one experience, like maybe even one of the first experiences where you got to sit in on a meeting or something and it just blew your mind. You're like, wow, I'm really, really lucky I got this.
It's funny that you mentioned that. Actually, yesterday the SEC chairman from Washington, D.C. came down and visited us, and I was able to attend that meeting. And, just sitting there in front, this guy's from Washington, D.C., it blew my mind. And I'm in that presence, it's just crazy to think that how I'm involved now in, the United States government, and really excites me for what I can do later on in the future.
Any of your friends, do you get to talk to any of your friends and they're just like asking you, wait a second, dude, what are you doing, man? What kind of stuff do you get to do? It's kind of fun.
Yeah. And I signed a non-disclosure agreement. So, I kind of like to play with them sometimes and say, sorry, man, can't mention it. But
It's a secret. I'm not allowed to tell you. I'd have to kill you if I told you.
Exactly.
Donovan, this is the third year that the Children's Trust has provided this internship program for students across Miami-Dade. How did this all get started?
It is the third year, and it is also the first time in our county where we've had our county government, the Children's Trust, as well as the public school system and others from the private sector all collaborate on one focus of providing summer paid experiences. Our other partners at the table are CareerSource South Florida, Royal Caribbean Cruise Lines, and as I mentioned before, the public school system, as well as the county government. And our idea coming into this 3 years ago was really to figure out how can we get a meaningful experience for our older teenagers during the summer.
And, I mean, you look at the types of internships. How did you set that up? To get Nicholas in something like the SEC, I mean, what's the process of trying to set up these sorts of internships? And it's not some just whatever internship. I mean, it's valuable. This is something he's going to get a lot out of.
Right. I can tell you as a high schooler, I never had a resume. So, you know, Nicholas has a resume, and he's been, you know, trained, I think, appropriately in job interview skills and all of that. And part of this is really through a marketplace that we designed called GetMyInterns.org, where students like Nicholas and others enter their credentials, their resume, and the industries they want to work in. And businesses from those industries go and they post their openings and the type of intern they're looking for, and then they actually interview and hire. So it's providing a real life chain of experiences from interview to job.
And who's eligible?
Rising sophomores and rising high school seniors. So typically age 15 through 18. If the student has a disability and still enrolled in school, they can apply up through age 22.
What's the application process like?
The application process, actually, the bar is not high. It's really to follow the process of Get My Interns, where there's some pre-employment work that you have to make. We have to make sure that our students are entering the workplace and entering the interview atmosphere prepared. And so there's some preparation ahead of time, but we also help them to develop and create a resume and really start to identify, you know, what type of experience they're looking for during the summer.
Nicholas, did you have a resume before this?
Well, actually, our Coral Senior High School really prepared us for all this. We went as far as having mock interviews for the
You mock interviews?
Yeah, HR professionals from all over Miami-Dade. So we've truly been blessed for the opportunity we've been giving.
All right. Oh, my goodness. Yeah, no, I mean, you know what? Donovan, I agree with you. I remember in high school, I didn't have a resume either. I don't even remember when that started to pop up in my vernacular. Real quickly, what focus, Donovan, what focus do you have on getting students from low-income communities?
Well, fun you should ask. You know, this year we are proud, and this has been the case year after year. Nearly 85% of the kids in the program this year qualify for free and reduced price lunch. And so when you think about kids who are less advantaged across the county, and, you know, knowing that you're going to have additional income into those families of nearly $1,400 for the time that they're working, that's a big deal. And in addition to that, when we look over time, over the last 2 years of records that we have, because part of the process is also to get all of the interns banked. They're paid through direct deposit, so they get a bank account. They have some financial literacy counseling. And when we look at that, 86% of those bank accounts still remain open with a balance of, on average, about $300.
We're talking with Donovan Leeson, the director of the Summer Youth Internship Program that offers work experience to high school students in Miami-Dade County. Also joining us, one of the students participating in the program, Nicholas Mesa. He's interning with the United States Securities and Exchange Commission. All right, Nicholas, by the way, I mean, the fact that this is a paid internship, I mean, was that a factor or is more about where you're interning?
You know, I think for the past two summers, you kind of have that mindset where you're not really doing anything. You know, maybe have a little summer reading. So I was actually excited to get, no matter the payment or anything, to, you know, be doing something with my summer and something meaningful for later on in the future. And I think a lot of my friends were excited about that, too. Just to get out there, and this, at the end of the day, this is going to set us apart in the job market in a few years after college and all that. So I think we were all really excited, no matter the payment or any of that, just get out there and be doing something and something meaningful.
And you know, for you, my understanding is getting the opportunity to work in this sector is important for you as well, because your family has been in the public sector and public service as well. So you kind of grew up around this.
Yeah. My dad is actually a firefighter for Miami-Dade County. You know, I've always looked up to him, what he's done. One story I can actually tell you, when Hurricane Katrina hit Louisiana, he had to leave for about a week. Obviously, I was 4 years old. I didn't understand the magnitude of what had happened, but I missed it. I was heartbroken, you know, but when I look back at it now, it's more, I saw what he sacrificed. I saw the service and the duty that he had to the people. And looking back at it now, I idolize that, and I want to do the same thing. I want to give back. I want to have that duty to the people. I want to serve them.
What has this internship done for you in, you know, helping you decide, for example, what you want to study, what school you want to go to, you know, after you're finished with high school, where you'd like to go and continue your education? What has this internship done to help you in that decision making?
Yeah, you know, working at the SEC has truly been awesome, because another thing, like, they have a whole bunch of different departments, so I've been able to be exposed to, you know, attorneys, accounting, examiners, and the IT department, all those different types of career paths that I didn't exactly know existed. You know, I thought government, let's say, you just had to be a lawyer, and that was it. But I've now been exposed to all these different career paths, and you can specialize in something, you know, so, so specific. And if you like it, you're having fun every day, and when you wake up, you're excited to go to work. So it's really opened my mind. I've now actually considering law, because of what I've been exposed to, you know, all the documents, all the document productions. And for college, you know, I'm looking at UF definitely for sure, and maybe apply a few Ivies too.
Yeah. Oh, look at that. All right. Well, UF is, I could say, go Gators. All right. you know what, Donovan, how many students have participated in this program so far? This is just a few years old, but it's reached out to a lot of people.
Correct. So the first year, our goal was just figure out, you know, coming out of the gate, how we can get nearly 1,200 kids employed. And that year, we had nearly 1,500. Last year, we aimed for 1,500, and we had 1,800. This year, we have just over 2,500 kids enrolled, going to work every day and earning a living.
Something you said a moment ago, this is a really interesting part of this internship, is that the students have to open up a bank account.
Correct.
You're teaching them, on top of giving them this opportunity, you're teaching them personal finance. Why the bank account, and what is it you're trying to help them gain?
Well, a number of things. When you think about the number of folks in this town that don't have a bank account, and it doesn't mean they're not working. It means they don't have a bank account. And so they're marginalizing their income by having to go to check cashing and these other places. When you cut that out and you start to think about mainstream banking, building credit, building wealth, and looking towards building income towards the future, having that financial education and that grounded financial stability is helpful for the distance, for the long run.
Now, you know, as I mentioned, the program's still relatively new, but I mean, have you seen some success stories that you know, are most proud of, that you can look back on and say, yeah, that's we helped that kid do that?
There are a number of them, and so the big picture things that I'd say that we're most proud of is the willingness of our business sector. We have nearly 850 businesses hosting interns this year. When we look at the banking and financial practices of the students who've been enrolled, you know, when you think about 86% of all the bank accounts opened are still open with a balance, and it's almost $1 million in the pockets of kids, in the hands of kids who are your future leaders, your future decision makers, your future elected officials, and so on and so forth. That is, for us, exciting.
So I'm sure that there are parents listening right now, maybe some kids, I don't know, it's summertime, but you know, some students, I should say, but what would you tell them about the application process, and how they, if they want to find out more for, you know, the next summer, what would you tell them? What's the advice? Where can they go?
They can go to miami.getmyinterns.org. That is the clearinghouse for everything that involves this process. But more important than that is apply early.
Apply early. Again, how many applications?
we have 2,550 students this year so far.
Again, talking with Donovan Lee Sin. He is the director of the Summer Youth Internship Program, again, offering these amazing experiences to high school students in Miami-Dade County. We also heard from Nicholas Mesa. He is one of the interns in that program. He is interning at the United States Securities and Exchange Commission. Nicholas, Donovan, it's been a pleasure, man. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for having me.
And Nicholas, good luck to you, man, as you move forward.
Thank you so much.
All right. Well, that's the program for today. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a wonderful day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.